Well, let's see. My the way that I got into fern industry, my father was a school principal. My mother was a school teacher. They were not in the fern industry. My dad did own an orange grove over on the coast of Florida. But in 1950, I married my wife, and her father was a successful fern grower, one of the, I guess, one of the leading fern growers in this area at the time. And at that time, when we were married, I had a grocery store, and which was, you know, fairly successful. We didn't go broke or anything, but he encouraged me to go into the fern business. He had been pretty successful. He felt that I'd probably be more successful in the fern business than I would in the grocery business. Greenland. His son is in, son and grandson are in the business now. His name was Oscar Greenland. And yes, he lived in Pearson. His son Freeman is a local fern grower, and Freeman's son Bobby is in the fern industry. I guess why Pearson, over 100 years ago, members of the Pearson family who were living here, for whom the town was named, had they had moved to this area from Connecticut, and their relatives had been wholesale florists and growers, flower growers in Connecticut, and they seemed to think at that time the only green was Asparagus plumosus, which they had grown in hothouses, I guess, in Connecticut. So they felt that maybe it would be conducive to this soil in this area, and they could grow it, you know, under a partial type shade arrangement. Yes. And they would build what became known as the slouses. They'd build the houses out of lumber, and the top would be the slats, which would be 3 or 4 inches apart. At that time, yeah, it was, well, now it is. At that time, probably the lumber that they would use would be probably $5 or $10 per 1,000 feet, whereas today it would be several, maybe $1,000 per 1,000 feet. So it's, you know, prohibitive today. But that, I guess, was the beginning of the fern industry, the plumosus that was grown. Then after a while, the growers began setting it under the oak trees using the natural shade. And this continued until, I guess, the late 40s or the early 50s. And then there was a grower by the name of J.C. Mayfield that lived just south of Pearson. And there was a lady by the name of Pauline Poole who lived down near Mr. Mayfield. And Mrs. Poole had a few leatherleaf fern plants under an oak tree in her front yard. Yes. So Mr. Mayfield persuaded Mrs. Poole to either sell or give him a few of the plants, and he set them in a little plumosus fernery that he had in back of his house.
It was just
shade. Yes, just the slat top shade. And the fern grew off pretty well and flourished, and he started selling a little locally. And it seemed to catch on among the wholesale florists around the country. And those plants seemed to be the best variety that we could find locally. So henceforth, the premium leatherleaf plant is known as the Mayfield variety. It came from Mr. Mayfield. And from then blossomed, I guess, the leaf industry. Plumosus was here first. That was, for many years, plumosus was the only green that was grown here. Then leatherleaf became into prominence. And now we have diversified into other things, not on a large scale, but within the last few years, tree fern has become very popular. And in addition to that, we grow some spring rye. Then we have what we call the bushes, like the variegated and the green pedosporum, the podocarpus, things like that. So there is a wider variety today than there was several years ago.
Is there a map of things?
Yes. Yes, there. Demand has grown and grown over the years. I was telling someone the other day, when I was in high school here, at that time, all of the fern was shipped by Railway Express. We'd have a train that would stop here every day and pick up the fern. And I worked for Mr. Hartley, who was a station agent, and had the Railway Express agency. And I would work on the, what we call the fern platform. The growers would bring their boxes of fern. In those days, were shipped in a wooden box. They'd bring their boxes of fern up to the fern platform. We would stack it up. Then the local train would come through. And then we would load it onto the express cars. And in those days, that was back in the early 40s. In those days, a big shipping day would be like 325 or 350 cases, maybe. That'd be the total industry in this area. Well, now today, many growers will ship many more than 300 cases of fern a day, individually. So it's grown from...
Do they use
most, probably today, 75 or 80% of all the fern is shipped by refrigerated truck. Some is shipped by air. Air has never become very prominent in shipping. The rates are pretty high, and then there is no refrigeration. The schedules are not too good. There's no refrigeration on an airplane, and if you ship it to St. Louis, and it has to go to Atlanta and change planes, and maybe there's a delay there, and it would sit out on the runway for a day or so in the hot sun. It doesn't work out too well. But domestically, refrigerated trucks have proven to be the best method of transportation.
Is there anything about the location
here
and the type of
soil? Yes. You know, strangely enough, leatherleaf especially thrives on a very poor, porous type soil. You could grow, actually, you could take building sand and plant leatherleaf in it. And if you kept it watered and fertilized, you could grow leatherleaf fern. It thrives on a poor soil. In a low hammock-like soil, it just you cannot grow a good grade at all. They call those hammocks, but they're not, you know, the... I don't know what the definition of a hammock is, but you know, you think really of a hammock, yeah, or a hammock land as being low, or I do, I think of it being low land. But these, the oak hammocks are high land where the fern is grown.
I guess I'm
taking a nap in a hammock, yeah.
Under the shade.
Yeah. No, the river has no effect. Yeah, just, I guess, you know, I don't think that the Pearson family came to this area specifically to grow fern. I mean, I don't know why they moved here. It was a Swedish settlement in the beginning, and they were Swedes. Now, I don't know why they came here, but this is, it's just, this soil is ideal for growing the different types of fern. Yes, very labor intensive. Yes, I would say 50 years ago, there weren't many large fern growers, as we think. Well, there weren't any fern growers on the scale that we have today. Most of the 50 years ago, most of the fern businesses were family type operations and hiring. There was quite an influx of people here from Georgia. There was a lot of Georgia labor. Fellas had come here, you know, and worked in the fern business. And then many of them stayed here and, you know, established their own businesses.
But, is this an area
of a lot of fern sales? Yes, not, you know, nothing like down in, you know, the central part of the state, the lower part of the state. But There was quite a citrus industry here, but no longer. No. I don't know. Now, on the south, you know, there are a lot of... Yes. But in this area, I don't know of any live trees. I really don't. There are probably a few around. Oh, probably... Mexicans started coming in back maybe 15 years ago, smaller scale. But now, our cutting labor, the labor that cuts the fern, cuts the bunches of fern, it's practically all labor, all Mexican now. I'd say 90%. There's still some black labor. I have a couple of black crews, but a lot of the growers don't hire any blacks at all. I think really it kind of basically reflects on all the entitlement programs we had. You know, really, they didn't have to work. They can make practically as much, you know, by not working. And there was a period, you know, that it seemed that, you know, that the government was promoting these programs, you know, they were, you know, inviting people, rather, you know, to get on these programs rather than work. Whereas I guess it's changed somewhat now, but I think that had a great to do with it. They had no pride in their work. They still don't. I mean, all candor, I'd rather have a Mexican crew than I had a black crew. The Mexican people are very congenial. There's no arrogance about them, you know. You have a tremendous amount of arrogance with your blacks. I guess it reflects whatever. But, you know, it just seems you have a better situation among the Mexicans than you do the blacks. Mm-hmm. And I guess the conditions, you know, from which they came are so poor, you know, in Mexico, the labor type people in Mexico are so poor that, you know, they can come here and make $200 or $300 a week cutting fern. It's so much better than they've been accustomed to.
Just in person, do you feel like migrants? I'm trying, you know, it's like the articles that they wrote from Jacksonville,
mm-hmm. Yes. No, it's, no, really it is not. I mean, I read those articles from Time Union, and, you know, you do get that impression. This is not, no, it's not, you know, there is a big migrant labor pool, you know, they'll come into Florida, I guess, and pick oranges a certain period of time, and go down around Lake Okeechobee and work in the vegetable crops, you know, but they're just seasonal. They're just, you know, one crop per year type operation. But here, when they come here and become established, I mean, there's no, you know, there's no migrant aspect to it. They can stay here forever.
There are some people that do come through that are part of the migrant system.
Yeah, yes, yeah, I guess. I know some of, there are, now, there are some migrant type people that come in that go, they don't work in this, they'll go up and work up the East Coast, work the crops up there, you know. Then they'll come back to Florida. That's usually, I guess, in the fall they'll come in, you know.
There's going to be a couple of fellows that went to one of the Mexican dances.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, a fellow from Mexico City. Just in case for a short period, they're going to Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I guess there's some of that. Yeah. That's not, that's the exception, it's not the rule. Yeah, most of them are pretty firmly established too, you know. Well, you know, it's not an annual type crop. We're cutting, you know, the year round. And normally, now I'm experiencing something right now, and a lot of the other growers are too that I talked with. And I have never had this happen before, and I've been in this thing for 30 some odd years. Last week, I had an extremely slow week as far as business was concerned. And I had never, ever had a slow week like that at this time of the year. Normally, from about the peak of your season, if you call it that, it's from the middle of January to about the middle of May. There are about 4 months there that you're really going, you know, last year at this time, the boys in the packing house were working 7 days a week. We're not doing that now. Business is slow, and I don't really know why it is. It's just... I know the quality of the fern is poor, you know, after the severe freeze. But last year we had the Christmas freeze. The quality of fern was poor. But business is just, I don't know if it's a reflection on too much fern now or what's causing it. But it's a situation I've never experienced before. It's not going to be a booming week this week. Yeah, Easter's a good holiday. You have three major holidays: Valentine's, Easter, and Mother's Day. Mother's Day is the biggie.
Big for whoever the phone company.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So you're cutting all your wool, like all varieties of
things? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we ship 52 weeks a year. But our peak season is normally from the middle of January to the middle of May. And now last year, we had a fairly consistent year, probably the most consistent year I've ever had, from January through December. The slow period, July, you know, that's in the height of the summer, that's usually pretty slow. And we usually experience a slow month in December because of the competitive type greens that they use for Christmas, the evergreens, you know, they call them the Christmas greens. The evergreens have grown out in the Northwest, places like that. They are very competitive, and for that reason, business slows up.
What happens to the roses before then?
Sometimes, now some of the Mexican help, they'll go back, you know, they like to go home maybe once or twice a year or something like that. And some of them will, you know, plant it for December when they know it's going to be slow, and they'll take off maybe a couple, 3 weeks or whatever, go home, you know, and celebrate the holidays or something.
That's what I was happy to learn, that the peak of Mother's Day that God's Osborne will be considered a festival until the 24th and 25th of May.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So at least it's a period where most people can't. How is fern
A leather leaf plant. Now, a plumosus plant is started from seed, from a seed. In fact, some I remember years ago, I haven't heard of it in quite a number of years, but some of the growers would order seed. I guess plumosus probably it all began maybe in Italy.
Kind of a soft,
delicate like, yeah.
And
yes, yeah. Yeah, practically all grown under trees now. But some of the growers would buy seed from Italy, and I guess they had the better quality or something. But it is, you would set, if you wanted to, you know, establish a plumosus fernery, you could set the seed in what we would call a seed bed, set them in rows, you know, closely together. And after they'd get up maybe 4 or 5 inches tall, then you would dig those up, you know, out of the seed bed, then set them in, you know, in the fernery. And now, leatherleaf begins from a spore. That's actually, I guess, a seed that grows on the underside of the leaf. We call them spores, but they're actually seeds. And they will, at a certain time of the year, a young seed is either kind of a light color, kind of a light greenish color, then they mature. They get dark, black, but you can take those, and then they'll drop off that spray of fern, that leaf. But I know I had a neighbor several years ago that I hadn't heard of too many people doing this, but he took some seed, took some spore, he scraped them off the back of these plants, and he set them, he had him a little tray there, and he set them in building sand, you know, with water, had a little sprinkler system, a little mist system on them constantly, and he grew some plants from those spores.
Try that when I go get it.
Yes, so that's the way it begins. Of course, now, when we're not, we just set a fernery, and what we do after you get established, you just dig plants that you have already established in the fernery mode and separate them and set those. Yes, thin them out. Dig up the existing beds and just thin them out.
So inside of the fernery, the spores just dropping in, it's just constantly germinating?
Well, no, they usually, I tell you, they won't spore. Normally, there's enough shade, I guess, for a plant to produce spores. It has to be in quite a bit of sunlight, and in the average shade in a fernery, there won't be enough sunlight, and that fern will not produce those spores. But you will get them. Where you will get them will be around the outside of a fernery, maybe at the end of a bed where it gets a lot of sunshine, direct sunshine. And sometimes then those things will spore up real badly and then they'll turn dark, you know. Of course, that fern in the florist, they don't like to have the fern with all the seeds on them. But normally you don't, like I say, where there is adequate shade, you don't have much problem with the fern sporing.
So once you start
the day one,
buy
plants? Yes. Mm-hmm. There isn't much of that. There is, I guess, some, but not much. Now, they have shipped, some of the growers that have established ferneries in Costa Rica have shipped plants from here, you know, to Costa Rica and reset them.
How far north is it? Is this one going up?
Oh, about, yeah, I would say, I used to say, and I guess it's still basically true, I don't know, maybe there's enough in some other countries now this wouldn't be true, but I used to say that 80% of the fern grown in the world was grown between Crescent City and Orange City, Florida. Orange City is just south of DeLand. Because, you know, basically the fern industry is DeLand, DeLeon Springs, Barberville, Pearson, Seville, Crescent City. And most of it in the world, I think, is grown. There's some fern over in Lake County, and you'll have isolated instances of maybe down on the East Coast there'll be one fernery somewhere or something. But most of it's right in this area.
Would you say now that shouldn't be
Yeah, well, that would be a factor, the labor in the soil. There's quite a little fern. I mean, nothing like in Volusia County and Putnam County. There's some fern over in Lake County, you know, around Leesburg and those little towns there, Yalaha, Okahumpa, typical Indian type names. You weed now in the. Our routine on weeding, we will begin weeding now practically any time. Then I have a crew that they'll weed from then, they'll weekly from then until up into December probably. So you're weeding probably at least 8 months out of the year.
Oh, okay. I thought it was saved something.
Well, not really. You do most of your weeding during the slack period because the slack period is in the summer, you know, and the weeds are growing more then. If you get everything pretty well cleaned out by the 1st of December, then normally you won't have to, you know, you get in your winter months and you don't have much weed problem.
So people are paid by the hour for the
year? Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, there is some contract work. Now, the weeders that I have, I've had this crew now for several years, and we have a crew leader, a lady, and I pay her just a flat sum of per day wage, you know. And then all the weeders that work for her are paid the minimum wage. But some growers, they'll hire a crew of weeders and take them out, and there'll be an acre of fern. They'll make a deal, say, well, I'll give you $400 to pull that acre or something. They'll do it like that.
So it's just different.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Most of it's on a daily, on hourly rate.
For
weeding. Yes.
What about cutting?
It's a piece work, you know, so much per bunch. Yeah.
What's an average bunch? Is there a certain number of
pieces? Yes. In a leather leaf bunch, it's 25. 25 pieces or sprays per bunch. Plumosus is, oh, it'll vary, 35 to 40 sprays usually.
So the orders come in by
bunch? Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what we call the brush. That's the wire and brush type fernery. That was popular 10 or 15 years ago with leather leaf because it does grow, you can grow a good quality of leather leaf fern under that. But we are getting away from it. In fact, in a few years now, I don't think there'll be any more wire and brush ferneries. You would build those things and put up what you'd call your stringers, your wooden tube of fours, whatever it was, from post to post. Then you'd buy regular chicken wire and nail across that. Then there was a brush, we call brush a rosemary variety, that grows prolifically over in the Ocala National Forest and over around Williston and Chiefland up in there. And they would go over and cut those big clumps of that rosemary, and then we would put that on top of the chicken wire. And it made a good partial type shade, you know. But what happens after a few years when that chicken wire begins to rust out, then you have all kinds of problems, that stuff falling in, you know. And then over the years, your brush, it'll break off and shrivel up and have to rebrush. And
Do those have anything on the side? They just be open on the side and brush on the top?
It would depend. Some of them would have something on the side, some of them would not. Might have a wooden side or maybe just a piece of shade cloth or something.
From the old days, when they
just
use the wooden top, they didn't have
anything
on top of it?
No, just the wooden slats.
Mm-hmm. The brush came later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What would you say are essential if you're going to start a fern in this time? Especially under the change in weather conditions. Can you start fretting when they down here?
Yes. You know, now there's going to be a transition in the way we protect this fern. Because, you know, this water, I think, will be managed pretty well. And a grower from the land has used a system that I believe is going to prove to be pretty effective. He has his shade cloth ferneries, just like any other fernery, with his regular conventional type water system, have sprinklers like 30 or 40 feet apart, whatever. But then in addition to that, he runs these sprinklers up through the top of that fernery. And what he does, then when it gets down to freezing, he turns the water on the sprinklers that go through the top. And he'll form a layer of ice on top of the fernery. Then when he gets that layer of ice formed, he turns those sprinklers off.
You're on the inside, they're not touching the fern.
No, it's on the top of the fern, the top of the shade cloth. And then, like I say, when he gets that iced over, and the temperature will be below 32, he turns that off, and that sheet of ice will remain up there.
Can you do
that this year? Yeah, and it works pretty effectively. And then if it gets, you know, then when that temperature begins to drop substantially below 32, then he'll turn on his regular system inside the fernery. And between the two, it's pretty doggone effective.
Why would it be better than 17?
Be cheaper. You know, heat is so expensive. Yeah, any type of heat now. I mean,
well,
you...
yeah.
Yes. She had a problem with that this year, didn't she, of some kind? It looked like just riding by there was some dead fern in there. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And they had
two
sort of pictures of ice and
yeah.
Bird.
Yeah.
They don't have
years
at all.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a little of that being, you know, experimenting with, but I'm afraid cost is going to be pretty prohibitive on any kind of heat, really.
And what's the material for the shading?
Saran, we call it a saran shading cloth.
What about the cloth?
Polyethylene or whatever.
Isn't that
creating that? Well, you take it off. You know, that's that. The plastic is just a temporary situation. When you put that up, you know, come this time, a little later now, they'll take all that down. Yeah, man, if you left that thing up during the summer, you'd burn that fern up completely. I don't really know. They're going. Yeah, the geologists tell us, you know, they've established these sample or test wells, and apparently we are.